to Obstinate Headstrong Girls. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jessica.
And we're two best friends talking about romance movies with another friend. Today we have Jack with us.
Hey. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on. And we watched You've Got Mail.
Hashtag You've Got Mail, to throw back to my other episode that I was on, Intercepted.
Oh, yeah.
happy to be your hashtag obstinate headstrong guy. I feel honored.
Yes. Well, I felt like we need to talk about a movie with you, and we need to talk about this specific movie because of it's just an homage to the Upper West Side.
I really appreciate that. Amy, I don't know if you know, but I grew up on the Upper West Side. So like, this is like just like every half of my notes are just like, oh yeah, that place. Oh yeah, that store. Oh yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Amy, I was like, all right, we're ready. And Roscoe immediately got up and like belched loudly. Like, we're not ready, Mom. You knew that.
He's like, allow me to quickly just make distracting noises.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I read something surprising this week.
A prologue?
Oh, I did read a prologue and I'm so pissed. I opened this book and I was like, But then I figured out it is a series and there is a first one. And there was information that I needed to know. And I didn't know that I had downloaded the second book in a series because I don't pay attention when I buy books.
Yeah.
And so, like, I guess it was information I needed, but as soon as I see the word, I'm just like, ugh. But I enjoyed the book.
What was the surprising thing that you read?
So it's called White Hot by Alana Andrews. And I just picked it up on like Kindle Unlimited, and it was a very action-y, contemporary, paranormal. And the reason I like one clicked it, I was like, this isn't my like normal thing, but it looks fun, so I'm gonna snag it. And then it was fun and I enjoyed it.
Even though it was the second in a series, were you like, wait a second, I'm missing something? Or were you like, oh, this is a choice, we're kind of starting in the middle? Interesting.
Yeah, I've done that to myself before, and it definitely wasn't an issue. With most romance, you can start anywhere in a series and it doesn't matter because you're following a specific couple. This one, there was way more callbacks to like the setup in the first book, and I think it's because it was like an action story, and so like part, like a big piece of the action happened in the first book, and this was like a continuation. So if I had to go back and do it again, I probably would start with the first one. But I enjoyed the second one.
I've always had been of two minds of like sequel books that, I mean, even movies really, but sequel books that like excessively called back to the first one, like reminded you things. Part of me is like, I guess that's important. But part of me is like, we know, like I'm thinking of the Harry Potter books, especially. And I remember listening to like, I had like on CD Walkman, Prisoner of Azkaban. And I would like fall asleep to that, or the cassette of Chamber of Secrets. And also had the CDs of Goblet of Fire too. That was like I still fall asleep listening to things like that. But they would be in the early chapters of those books, especially the earlier books. It's like, remember, Ron was Harry's best friend. And I'm like, yeah, we know. We've been reading these books. Like, you don't need to tell me like, so-and-so was the ghost who lived in Gryffindor Tower. Like, yeah, we're aware who Nick is. Like, we've been reading these books for a while. So like, I would imagine like books like that though, who's like, I'm going to pick up the Harry Potter books. I'm just going to start with Chamber of Secrets, right? Why not? Who cares?
Someone who loves chaos.
That's like a wild move to me, but I wonder if there's someone on the planet Earth who's done that.
That makes me think of the Babysitter Club's books. Amy, did you read those too?
Mm-hmm.
Where the first like five chapters of any book you could just basically skip because it was like Mallory likes this and Christy's into sports.
Well, see, those I kind of get. Because A, those for a younger audience. I guess Harry Potter is too, but like those are like, there's like 50 million of them. So it's like, well, we're all going to kind of set the world up and you're never going to read this sequentially. They're like episodic. Mm-hmm. So I kind of get some of that catch up, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you're reading a bunch, you're like, yep, I know this already.
I, in my personal choices, only do it with romance where I like pay no attention at all to series order or if something is a series. I guess I don't read a lot of non-romance, though, for it to be, like, an issue.
So, Alana Andrews sounds familiar to me, and I can't remember why. I guess I could just look in my Goodreads to see if I've read anything by her, but.
So I do have a philosophical question. So this book is called White Hot.
Excellent.
And there is a shirtless man on the cover with a lady all pressed up against him.
Check, I texted it to you.
Okay, thank you.
There are heat moments throughout the book. There is only one bang, and it is post 90%.
Interesting choice.
I feel like that is mixed signals from that type of a cover.
Okay, so I conceptually agree with you. Jack, do you see the picture?
I do. It's quite the, I'm obsessed, like generally obsessed with the like, just like the format of all these novel pictures. They're very, like just like glancing at a few occasionally. It's very like, oh yeah, there's this like this pose, there's the like leaning over pose.
Do I have a Twitter account for you?
Okay, so I agree with you, Amy. I think it's misrepresentative, but two things that would give me pause to be like, this is not about banging is one, the fact that the letters are frosted. So it seems like they took White Hot to be, you know, very much of the frostbitten nature. And then it's also, sorry, an Avon Books imprint.
Oh, I didn't even notice that part. I feel like Avon bangs, though.
Well, Amy will report back to us on that later because I could just be making an assumption.
Yeah. I will. I'll file a report.
I have one follow-up question. Did you find this in your hunt for category romances?
I didn't. It was an accident. So that's good, too.
Oh, okay. Like we said, we're here to talk about
insert sound mail. Effect. You've got mail.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the but if you were pausing for dramatic effect, you're going to insert the actual sound effect into this or not.
I mean, I wish we could. I'm sure I could figure that out. I was pausing because I was trying to think of the words you've got mail.
I will have to say, I have to just look up front and say this. My screen name on AOL was MovieMan5289.
Dang.
So this is right up my alley.
That's pretty good.
What was y'all?
Yeah, what was yours, Amy?
That's so embarrassing, you guys.
Oh, of course it is.
And guarantee it's not as embarrassing as mine.
March, baby. Day and year. So it was my birthday, basically.
Oh, so you're not saying your birthday. Sorry, I just...
No, you're fine. I was in my head. I was like, should I say my full birthday, including year? Then I was like, probably not, but I can say it this other way and that'll be fine.
Mine was Craneater 2000.
Like Crayola crayons?
Yeah, Crayon Eater 2000.
Why?
You know, I wish I could explain it. I don't really know. But yeah, it was. This movie, I mean, we've started with the AOL of it all, so I feel like we need to discuss this. Like, just the distinct memory of having the AOL disc that would arrive in the mail and be like, you get 5 free hours of internet.
Oh, wow. I forgot about that.
So when they made this movie, they made a special website for it because that was part of the cross promotional. You'd get the disc and put it in and this website would pop up and you'd like be able to go to a chat room.
Oh my gosh. I feel like my time on the internet was slightly after the AOL discs. Like I was full on dial up.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I remember. Yeah. I guess they're doing dial-up too. It's 98. When did the movie come out? 98?
Yeah. So you had to have dial-up to use the AOL like disk or whatever. And then it would just pull up this very like it's not the same way the internet is now. Yeah. The other thing about this movie, and we can get more into the quotes in a little bit, is some of the quotes in this movie I then used as my away message in AIM. So the layers are there.
I love when they jump into AIM later in this movie. I love that moment.
Yeah.
And they're like, I thought you'd be on here. And it's like, all right, now we're getting into it.
Now we're cooking. All right. So You've Got Mail came out in 1998. So just before all the other movies we've talked about recently. The description is, struggling boutique bookseller Kathleen Kelly hates Joe Fox, the owner of corporate Fox Books chain store that has just moved in across the street. When they meet online, however, they begin an intense and anonymous internet romance, oblivious of each other's true identity. Eventually, Joe learns that the enchanting woman he's involved with is actually his business rival. He must now struggle to reconcile his real-life dislike for her with the cyber love he's come to feel.
Yeah.
Cyber love.
That's really, well, it's funny. They mentioned cyber sex in like one of the end of the first act or something like that. And that's really the only sexual, thinking about today, that's really the only kind of reference to sex at all that was ever mentioned in this movie. It really is. I feel like now I was thinking about, like, I guess this is like a four quadrant movie in the sense of like, it's marketed to families as well. Like, I saw it shortly after it came out, I believe, and I was 9 in 1998. So like, that makes sense that you're not going to have the sex scenes and things like that. Then you wouldn't, like, adult rom-coms, right? And adult rom-coms, there probably would be sex, but there is not at all. It's like devoid of sexuality, really.
And even in the couples they start with, where they're in longer term relationships and like kind of living together, there's no implication that her and Greg Kinnear have had sex.
Oh, none. Greg Kinnear would be like, like, let me tell you more about Ethel and Julius Rosenberg.
He's like, I'm going to sleep with my typewriter tonight.
Oh my God. Like, all right, honey. I want to, but I need you to like to click, clack, click and bing. All right, good. All right, I'm ready now.
So this is Nora Ephron and her sister Delia. They did this one together. She's like the queen of rom-coms somewhat.
Yeah, I would say so.
Mm-hmm. And I also feel like this was kind of peak Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan power. Well, I feel like she was on her way down and he's just continued to do work. I know that negates the power of Kate and Leopold, but which was after this, but I still think this was kind of like her peak.
No, I think that's a fair enough statement.
When was Kate and Leopold?
It was after this.
It's funny. I was thinking about that and I was like, when was Harry Met Sally? That was 10 years before, right? Or was that in the 90s? I think of that as an 80s movie, but it's probably not an 80s movie.
It's 89. Okay. So it's right on the cusp.
Kate and Leopold is 2001. So 2 years, 2 to 3 years later.
I remember Kate and Leopold. I remember early in Kate and Leopold, there's someone talking about the Brooklyn Bridge and he keeps saying this erection and like a guy keeps laughing. And like, I remember that joke. It was a solid joke. He just keeps saying erection over and over again. And someone's like,
oh my God. So I think of all the Nora Ephron films, like I love this one. But when Harry Met Sally is still my favorite of all of her movies.
I haven't seen that in forever. I remember loving it when I first saw it years ago, but I need to revisit it. I was thinking about that watching this. I was like, I need to revisit Harry Met Sally because a movie that was big for me and is now I'm kind of reckoning with the fact that like, I still love this movie, even though I don't like this person, any of these other person's films or this person in general is Annie Hall, which was like a huge movie for me in high school and got like in college. And I feel like that's kind of like in a way, like one of the, like it has been seen, I guess, as like one of like the urtext of like the modern romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly problematic movie in various ways. It's also incredibly funny. And I think that aligns more with Harry Met Sally's type storyline than this. This really isn't drawing much from that at all.
No, I think this is drawing more on romantic comedies from like the 40s. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's based off of one from the 40s, I'm pretty sure.
It's very talky. because there's no sexuality or really like, you know, that kind of chemistry. It's all that kind of talky kind of chemistry. I mean, it's very like they have chemistry, obviously, and they're very charismatic together, but not in one way.
What I love about Nora Ephron movies is the way the lead, like the men and women in it, are usually on equal footing, which is like very different than, say, the Kate Hudson or the Gwyneth Paltrow rom-coms of like later or early 2000s. And so like Meg Ryan takes up just as much space in this movie as Tom Hanks.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting. Like just the structure of it was like two parallel lines that would kind of intersect occasionally, but it would be like, bam, ba, bam, ba, bam. Like they would have little vignette scenes alternating between the two of them. And they're just kind of parallel lives that would then kind of intersect when they communicate. But they were, it's really interesting structure wise, the way the story is structured.
Mm-hmm. And I think, go ahead, Amy.
I was just going to say, I think that it like really dives into what I think a romance novel would do when he decides that he needs to make her, like he needs to make her like him as Joe Fox. Like he realizes I can't reveal myself to be her pen pal because we're in too bad of a place. So I now need to do the work for her to be at least ambivalent about Joe Fox. And then I can think about that next reveal of I'm the person you've been talking to and I'm in love with you. And like that work and like that kind of montage, I was like, this is romance.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Yeah, there was a part of me that kind of loved that. It was really fun, but that dramatic irony, of course, like there had to be a point story-wise when one of them had to find out. Either they found out each other in the middle of the second act, and then there's the kind of, you know, the breakup and they come back together, or it has to be like, it has to end with them finding each other, with them both knowing, right? And they went for the second route, which is fine. Although there were times when I was like, wow, Hanks has all the power right now. He's like, I know everything, and you don't. And I'm holding these cards. And there were times when I was like, this is odd. I don't know.
Like I was thinking that he's lucky at the end that like she doesn't question how long he's known. Because he really is kind of just screwing with her for a while. Yeah, like having one conversation and then coming over here as like her pen pal and like poking at her from another angle. And like the fact that Meg Ryan decides that's cute instead of like very problematic is romance magic in a way. But I'm guessing after their first fight led to a conversation where she was like, and you did this and that's bull. And he was like, yeah, you didn't like, even
so I
say
guess
anything.
Ever since Cafe Lalo, ever since you're on with the book and the flower, really?
Yeah.
That was months ago.
Yeah. And so I guess in a way, I feel like this movie invented catfishing.
Yeah, I definitely had some catfishing feelings around this. Definitely. Yeah.
And like, I need to say just I guess we've kind of started diving in already. Like, I adore this movie and I left with nothing but positive feelings. No. But I think one, recording this podcast for the past year and then just like it's given me more of a critical eye to things to be like, huh, I've never noticed that before. Or if you think about it this way, it doesn't necessarily hold up, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to watch this and like endlessly continue to quote it.
Oh,
because
no.
I think it's such a masterpiece still.
Well, I feel like the dialogue is Nora Ephron, right? So it's funny, it's crisp, and it really is down to the casting for me. Like the premise of the story is kind of insane when you kind of like sit with it. You're like, he ruined her business, this like institution of the neighborhood, and that like her mom like has all these really traumatic things that happened to her because of him. And great, no big deal. Like, you know, it's just like that's the premise is and yet they're falling in love. Like it's a duff premise, and yet I think it's on the back of the fact that the two of them are incredibly charismatic and charming, and all the supporting cast is crushing it. You have Parker Posey, who's amazing, and Greg Kinnear's, like everyone. Chappelle is in this movie, and so like all of the scenes are fun in it all. Like you're never able to go like, wait a second, let me, although even though they speak to it, like this person got put you out of business, and yet everything's so charming, you're like, yeah, I don't care, I'm just so won over by everybody here.
And I was thinking about like, what if it was Matthew McConaughey? Like, I feel like you would just be like, that's insufferable. They're like, absolutely not. But for some reason, out of Tom Hanks, you're like, turns out I kind of love him. That's my bad.
I wrote down, is Tom Hanks attractive or just charming and charismatic?
I think charming and charismatic.
Right. Because he's not like.
He's definitely not stereotypically like Hollywood attractive. I think if you were in the same room with him and a person of that style is otherwise your jam, like I think he's an attractive man. I just don't think he's like Hollywood attractive.
That's the thing, right? And yet he's just like, you can't not, he's unbelievably charismatic and charming. He's so funny. He's so light on his feet. He has this warmth to him always. And this is, you know, of course, not unique to this movie. That's Tom Hanks. Why Tom Hanks is Tom Hanks. But I was thinking, I was like, it's interesting because like, you know, he isn't like, you know, were this out today, there'd be a shirtless scene and he'd be like whipped, or there would be like all these different elements. Granted, this movie's not sexualized, so he probably wouldn't have, but like Tom Hanks is Tom Hanks. He's like, just like a dad, but he's great. And he's so charming and charismatic that you're like, I'm won over by you. That's fine. Yeah.
Well, in the scene with his family, like they kind of set him up as this like his dad and his grandpa who are with their ridiculous mohair couch and like these total womanizers. And he's kind of like calling them on their bullshit and like rolling his eyes. So they set him up as this kind of like everyman who's just, yes, he's deeply entrenched in capitalism. And like, yes, he is trying to do things like, because I think this movie is trying to make a broader statement about like the gentrification of the Upper West Side of New York.
Yes.
So he's kind of the enemy, but he's still like, you know, he's going to help a stranger across the street. That's the kind of picture they paint of him.
No, definitely. And I think that that's just like, Tom Hanks can pull that off no matter what. It makes me want to rewatch a movie that's also flawless from the same era, also with Steve Zahn, who also killing it and always is That Thing You Do.
Dang. Yes, I was going to bring that up too.
Which is an absolutely phenomenal movie. It is so good and it holds up so well. And he is like not like a, like he's like the person who gives him the break, but he's also like, I'm a businessman. I'm a manager. I'm not like your friend kind of a guy. And yet he's so, you're never like, screw you, Tom Hanks. In that movie, you're like, oh, it's Tom Hanks. He's just so great.
Like, yes. I've heard so many, like read so many things where like people are just like, oh, I just randomly saw him on the street and he was as nice to me as like my uncle would be. Right. Like it seems like he's just pleasant.
COVID, people start taking COVID seriously. When he got COVID back in the day, people were like, oh shit, Tom Hanks has it.
He was like the first celebrity, I feel like, that had to come out and say that he had it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has that one horrible son, which I find hilarious to watch.
Colin?
News. No, Chet.
Oh, I was like, Colin Hanks, Orange County, baby, for life. Great movie.
Yeah.
So Upper West Side references. Like, tell me about it.
Oh, it's just all of it. Like that, honestly, I wanted to ask you guys, how does this movie, like, I mean, you both love this movie, so obviously it translates, but I'm just like, do you feel like, oh, they're referencing little things that I don't understand? Or like, you know, like more just like the shots, like they're at Zabar's and he's walking by H&H Bagels and they're just like that shot of all the stores opening up along Broadway in the 80s. And I'm like, yep, I know that place. I remember that place. And so it's just like, stuff like that. So like this movie came out in 98. So I was 9 and I grew up on 104th Street. So just north of there. But like that whole area, I know extreme, like, you know, it's my whole neighborhood. And so when they're wandering through 72nd Street, they're at Grace Papaya getting a hot dog. I'm like, oh yeah, that's where they are. Great. Awesome. You know, just like very comforting.
So I guess I have a brief question back. Were houseboats a big deal in New York, and actually live in them?
There is a marina right there. That's the 72nd Street Marina is like a known thing, and that's like where people have their sailboats, like Tom does, Joe, I should say. And so like when he was at the boat, I was like, yeah, 72nd Street Marina, I know where that is. That's just a bit above there is where I played Little League, so like on Riverside Park. So yeah, I know that marina very well.
Maybe how much does the location play into your love of the movie?
I feel like I don't have a super strong association of it to New York.
Okay.
So like, I feel like New York is a backdrop that isn't critical to the story in my mind. And
well, it's like a small town. Like they treat the Upper West Side, which it is like New York is obviously, you know, gigantic, huge, enormous city, but, you know, they have that few scenes of him in his corner office in Midtown. That's like, you know, Master of the Universe, New York. But then there's like the New York of the Upper West Side, which is, you know, brownstones and apartment buildings and people who had their whole communities there. And it's like a small town. Everyone knows each other, kind of a feeling. Obviously, there's still hundreds of thousands of people who live in the Upper West Side, but it still has that feel of like, especially in certain circles, like the literary circles, it has that small town feel. Mm-hmm. So like it could definitely, it tightens up the scope of everything.
And I wasn't specifically watching for this, so I'm wondering if you guys noticed, did they have any establishing shots of like iconic New York skyline, Statue of Liberty? I feel like that wasn't there at all, right? They weren't trying to say this is a New York movie, right? Like this is an Upper West Side movie.
Yeah, it's very much of like, I don't know, like a like they just have the cultural signifiers of like, this is New York. And I mean, they do acknowledge that it's New York and like the people are very, I feel like New York in their actions. And then just some of the conversations they're having, like where her, her assistant at the bookstore is like, if I lose this job, I'm gonna have to move to Brooklyn.
That was a great joke. By the way, hilarious joke now that like Brooklyn has become Brooklyn and like incredibly expensive. Like this is 98 before Brooklyn was like, I love that joke now in hindsight. It's hilarious.
It's amazing. So I feel like it's kind of, it's like that. Like if you know to look for it, then there's all these New York references. If not, it just has this, I almost feel cozy type feeling of fall in a city where you can walk out your front door and go to your niche children's bookstore shop, or you can go to your giant office in the middle of the city. So I think there's some of that for me.
What I find interesting is I love all the very like 90s Starbucks jokes. I feel like that was like when Starbucks became like part of the zeitgeist in terms of like being like a cultural joke. I also find it fascinating that she's like a Starbucks patron. Like
I wrote that down. I was like,
Zabar's. I'm like, she goes to Zabar's and goes shopping there. And that's the whole, cash credit card thing, which by the way, cameo Sara Ramirez from Grey's Anatomy. I was like, hey. And then later we have Chris Messina from freaking Mindy Project. Who's like, I was like, oh my God, these cameos. But like, there's other places to get a cup of coffee. And it's funny to me that she's this like, you know, small business, whatever, and yet she goes to Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally noted that too. And
I've been to that Starbucks so many times.
I feel like that scene only existed because Nora Ephron wanted to write like her kind of rambling thought about how Starbucks takes the effort out of ordering coffee.
Yeah. It's like a bit she had like in a binder somewhere. And she's like, I want to get this in. This is funny. I want to write this in.
Yeah. It's funny. I read an article about like what Nora Ephron was thinking when she wrote this character. And she's like, I want this to be like a legitimate bookstore, a literary bookstore where, you know, the woman who owns it, she still shaves her armpits. Like that was her, like that she wasn't some like hippie or something. Which I think it's funny because I mean, she was the height of fashion in 1998 and then we've made it full circle. So all the fashions come back.
For women's wear, by the way, I'm on board. Like she's so cute in this movie. Everything she's wearing. I love the little part-time job assistant and the very first thing with the tie on, which is very Annie Hall, the kind of like the tie. I love that outfit. You know, Meg Ryan has those sweaters and the jackets and the vests. She looks great. By the way, I haven't said it yet. She is so charming and so adorable. And just, the scene when she's doing like punching in the back, I'm just like unbelievably charmed by her. I'm like, how could you not fall in love with her? And you know, in that moment, like.
I felt like her charm was at like 100 when she's sick. And that scene where he's outside and she's like, And it's just her by herself in her apartment, like freaking out, shoving tissues, moving dishes. And then all of a sudden he's right there. And I'm like,
and she puts on the trench coat.
Yeah. It's just over top of the pajamas. She's like, I can't with a bra, but I can put on this coat. Like it's perfect.
This is an underappreciated physical comedy performance in the opening scene. with her kind of hustling Red Kinnear out and moving things around. And then Tom Hanks is the same kind of like scene with Parker Posey leaving. Like there's some really good physical comedy going down by A, Meg Ryan, and B, by Parker Posey, who's like never not like spinning in a circle, basically.
Yeah. Well,
in that sick scene, she, for whatever reason, and I mean, it's the comedy, she grabs the flowers and just walks around with them under her arm the whole time. Right. And it's so funny too, because Amy, it had me dying, because it's like kind of flipping that whole idea of being sexy with in a trench coat with nothing underneath to being like, I'm sick and need a Sudafed with pajamas underneath this trench coat. And he is all the while falling in love with her.
Well, that's the thing. Like he's falling in love with her because of her like shining light of her personality and her charm and her spirit. You know, she's never, I mean, she's gorgeous. And I was thinking watching this last night, I was like, okay, we're going to put in terms of Jack awakening to being interested in girls, we're going to put this performance, her, that character, and Elizabeth Hurley from Austin Powers. We're going to put those up in like, in my story of like, those are two of like the late 90s me as like a preteen, like, okay, something is starting to turn on in my brain. And those two kind of combined in some way. but like she's never, I mean, she's gorgeous and her hair, I mean, she's gorgeous, but she's not sexy in that term. And the movie doesn't ever try and make her sexy, which is fine. And so like, you know, the trench coat thing, like it is not ever trying to be like, there's no double entendre. There's no like, there isn't any of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think they had like Nora, like the writers had to show her in this tension of like being a boss and then like also wanting to be swept off her feet. And it was the way that was mastered was just like, as Amy would say, like chef's kiss. It was just perfect, you know?
Yeah.
Because you do see her as like, I want this small business to succeed. I want this to be an economic success, especially to carry on the family like tradition.
Interesting. We're thinking about the Starbucks. I was thinking of you know, our question of why are you eating at Starbucks? And I drinking at Starbucks. And I wonder if that's part of the point, which is like, look, at the end of the day, we're all consumers and we end up shopping at these places, just like you're going to end up going to Fox Books. Guess what? Now there's a Starbucks on 82nd, I think that is, you're going to start going there. Sorry. Like maybe at first when it opened, you were like, no, but the local coffee shop. And guess what? You're going to end up going to Starbucks anyway. And I wonder if like, that's kind of like the foreshadowing of like, because at first you're like, well, she's a small business owner. Why would she go to Starbucks? That's the high, that seems like the antithesis of all of this. And I wonder if like, that's the point. It's like, yeah, eventually she's going to go to Starbucks. And guess what? Eventually she'll probably buy a book at Fox Books because it's there now. And that's kind of the unfortunate direction of all of this.
Yeah, I think that could totally be true. So where I grew up was a suburb and we only had like box stores, basically. Like we had a big grocery store, we had a Target, and like that was kind of it. Like I didn't have a little shop that I ever went to that I ever worried like someday this little shop is going to close. And so I feel like it's funny watching this and still feeling some sort of almost like ingrained nostalgia for like the way the world used to be when like that was never my lived experience, really. Like I have that more now in the neighborhood I live in right now because like some small stores have started reopening and like I have a small coffee shop that we can walk to and like a little brewery that we can walk to. And I have that now as like a 30-year-old, but it was never a part, like a fundamental part of my childhood.
No, and it was for me. And definitely that was a whole thing where it's like, I remember very vividly the independent movie rental store on 105th and Broadway. The coolest guys were there. And I used to want to be like, oh, I want to be like these cool video guys. Right. And it was like very, it was indie. It was great. Then a few blocks down the road, Blockbuster opens. And I don't, you know, around that same time, they end up going out of business. Also, you know, now of course Blockbuster's now gone too. But then there's that Blockbuster ended up becoming a Strawberries clothing store. And then it became a City MD urgent care. Other places became like Walgreens or banks, kiosks. And so like you have in that neighborhood, especially a bunch of places that end up getting priced out because of rent probably. And then who else can go there? Okay. It's another freaking, you know, Wells Fargo branch or whatever ends up going to that place instead. But yeah, I feel like a lot of those small places, I mean, a lot of those bodega stuff still exists in New York. And I feel like a part of it is rent control. Just like they've had the place for forever. They're probably not paying that much rent because it's kind of been steady over the time. But like, I feel like cities like that are places where little places like that can just like succeed and like, or just somehow they're still there that little store that just fixes shoes is still there. Little shoe store, you know, that little pharmacy that's been there since the 40s, that's still there somehow, you know.
I wrote that down. Like, what are the economics of a children's only bookstore in a corner in New York City? But Jack, to your point, like sometimes there's the market for that in a larger city than,
And it's not on a corner. It's on like a side street. It's on like a side street, and it's got like a small, it's not a very big spot, but I mean, it's still, you know, primo real estate, but yeah, mm-hmm. I wonder how much she's paying in rent and if there's like a stabilization or for, she ever owned it or has a mortgage basically. I don't know. At some point, obviously she had to put out of business because they weren't making any money. But
I guess in real life it was a cheese shop, which is also uniquely
that place was?
Yeah.
Cheese and antiques, which I never would have paired as like this one shop is for cheese and antiques.
I love that so much.
Yeah. It feels like they'd have different temperature requirements.
I'd imagine you'd have like a cold shelf and a not. And this is an antique shelf. Yeah, I read that too. I was like, that is fascinating. But to go, I think this harkens back to what you were saying, Jack. Mm-hmm. At the end, after they've cleaned out the store, Meg Ryan's character says, what they'll be saying about this tomorrow is that it's like the inevitable passage of time and the city is always reinventing itself. And this will just be one more place that needed to be reinvented. And she's like, in fact, that's what I would say if this was anyone else's store, but that's not how I'll feel about this. And I feel like that goes back exactly to what you're saying about the Starbucks and like the natural passage of time. And like, you just have to move on.
Yeah. And there's yourself as a small business owner and there's the principle of it all. And then there's the economics of being a consumer. Like, Amazon is a horrible parasitic entity. And yet I will get stuff on Prime because guess what? It's cheap and it can be delivered to my house tomorrow. Like there's just those economic realities that are bigger out of our hands and we're just individual consumers. And so like, guess what? It's a place that's, I love, he said like, what was it? $2.95 or something like that. I love the price point of the coffee. Like I love like, but like, yeah, eventually, okay, I guess I'm going to go there and get a cup of coffee because that's there on my way to work or whatever.
Did you guys have pause when he buys four books, I think, from her shop, mm-hmm. one of them being a pop-up book, and it was $75. And I was like, that is insane.
The pop-up book was actually after, I thought. He did he got the price point, and then the pop-up book, he like gave it to his nephew. No, he gave it to his brother.
Uncle, brother, uncle, aunt.
No, I thought she was his aunt.
She's his aunt. He's his half-brother. Yeah.
Which I love that like joke of like, we're going to like kooky insano family.
Yeah, it was though. I think it was like $75 for four books. Mm-hmm. And then they add the pop-up, which I mean, Amy, we have just recently both been texting like, oh, I was trying to support this small bookstore to buy all the podcast books from there. And then I was going to be broke.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first note I wrote down was, I love a good epistolary romance. Like the fact that they're writing, not necessarily letters back to each other, but like that internal like dialogue that you get to see where like, and then the acting that they put into it. And I think this is kind of the physical comedy where like they're much more serious about the engagement of the email than we are when we're just like typing out text on Tinder. Like Tom Hanks, when he blows on his fingers to start typing away. And like how she, you know, how she, like she shoos Greg Kinnear out of the house. And I mean, they're full on having an emotional affair, which we can choose to ignore. But like the way they like put such seriousness into it, and then they write these beautiful things back to each other, just like thinking about the city, thinking about their lives. One of my favorite quotes came from that where she says, I lead a small life, small but valuable. Sometimes I wonder, do I do it because I like it or because I haven't been brave? I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
I love that line because that's definitely something that I can resonate. Like I definitely understand that push and pull where it's also like, you know, who are we to define what a big life is and what a small life is? Like maybe a big life and a beautiful life is just like, I'm going to have a good job that's rewarding in some way and focus on raising my family and having my friends. And like, yeah, if I don't climb up every single ladder and do X, Y, and Z, that's okay, because I have other priorities, you know? So, and like, and I also feel like why is trying to run a successful single small business not an incredibly ambitious thing to want to do? Why does it have to be like, well, obviously you're going to want to start a, you know, a nationwide brand. And obviously you're going to want to, you know, do multiple locations and brand your bookstore. And there's going to be a shop around the corner in every single city. No, like what, why can't it just be like, I want to have a place that's mine that is successful and it's my place and it's a space that I've created. And like, that's an incredibly ambitious, worthy undertaking for, for, you know.
She also says in one of her letters, she says, when you read a book as a child, it becomes part of your identity.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is so powerful. Amy, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on the role Pride and Prejudice plays in this movie.
Yes, I was thinking of that too.
I was too. And I was reading, I was like reading about it specifically. And it, I read something that said, like, you could see this as like a modern adaptation because of the way they interact with each other, which I think is a bit of a stretch, because like Pride and Prejudice is so much about like family dynamics in a way that this doesn't really dive into it. But I know that it's one of Nora Ephron's favorite books. So I love that she like folded it in. And I mean, any reference to it, I'm like, yay, Pride and Prejudice. But I feel like also Pride and Prejudice is such the quintessential like romantic book that you see it and you're like, of course you went with Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
Totally.
But is it that because it's 2021 and there's been a lot of, there's been continued references to it, or was it that 30 whatever years, you know, 23 years ago, you know?
That's true. And I'm not sure the answer to
that.
Yeah,
I don't know. I can't remember when the Colin Firth movie came out.
1996.
Beforehand. Okay, so beforehand, but it was kind of then in the ether more presently then. But I mean, it's been referenced a million times over since then. So I think that reference, if that movie came out now and it'd be that same reference, I think he'd be a bit more like, okay, of course, Pride and Prejudice.
I think that served it as a little bit more than a prop, because she does have to defend Elizabeth Bennet.
Yeah. Because he pokes at Elizabeth Bennet, which he's prepped to do because she's mentioned Pride and Prejudice in her emails.
And he's like, I love the bit of that. And he's just kind of like, trying to read it. And he's like, Jesus. I also wrote, like, think of like story things. I wrote his, these kids are his save the cat. You know, you know, the like narrative, was it Blake Snyder or whatever, like the narrative thing that's like the character has to save a cat or do something nice to somebody so you can get on board for him. So like, you know, he's this like viper on the bookstore. He's like this vamp, like he's destroying local bookstore. He's like basically Barnes and Noble's the allegory, of course. Right. And yet he's sweet with these kids. He's got a heart of gold. It's like, that's that moment him with the kids on the boat is like his save the cat moment. Like before that, we're like, okay, I know you're Tom Hanks, so I'm going to like you, but like, why am I supposed to? And then you see that scene and you're like, okay, never mind. You won me over now.
Yep, for sure.
You can have the like boardroom pew, 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 scene, but because I've seen you with the kids, so like, I'm on board for you now.
How amazing was it that the nanny and the new wife, like his stepmom, fall in love and run away together?
I did like that.
I wanted a spin-off movie.
What were you going to say?
One of the lines I wrote down, and Meg Ryan says it at the beginning to her shop friend. She says, is it infidelity if you're involved with someone on email? And in unison, my husband and I out loud went, yes.
I was gonna say, so Jess,
you mentioned that, and Jack, you made a face. So I'm wondering if you disagree.
And this is not me saying, like, oh my God, I gotta delete my emails. but like, I guess, like, I see what you're saying, right? Because this is beyond, there's emotional layers to this that's beyond, like, I'm striving up like a friendship with somebody. Though I don't know when that line gets crossed. Because like with a quote unquote affair, there's pretty much a clear when things become physical you know, you kind of think about that being, okay, now you're cheating on somebody else. But like, I understand the argument of, well, this is, you know, emotional intimacy. This is kind of this kind of connection. But at the same time, like, there's lots of different types of emotional intimacy. And does it mean that you're betraying the trust of your partner, you know, both of whom are unhappy in their relationship, but that's not an excuse for it. But like, that happens to be what they're doing. So of course they're looking for that connection somewhere else. But like, if you end up having a really close friendship with someone at work and you kind of have this kind of connection with somebody emotionally, is that betraying your spouse or your partner? Or is it just like, oh, I have another type of relationship with somebody? Like, when does it go into the line between kind of being like, this is now betraying the trust of our relationship, is what I'm struggling with.
So Amy, what do you have to say?
No, you go first.
I was going to say the difference for me here is the fact that she actively is like kind of hiding it. You know, she's like, if Greg Kinnear comes in the room, like she's shutting her computer. Well, see, like, and I mean, one, he hates computers. He's
I was
like,
going to say, is it really because of the chat room, or is it because he's like, this fucking computer, come on, I got an Underwood typewriter on the table over there. Click, clack, let's go. Like, send him a letter.
But I think it's also the willingness to confide in this online relationship about things that it seems like they're not sharing with their partner. And I think in the like work kind of friendships that you're talking about, usually you're not sharing things that you wouldn't share with your partner. And for me, that's the line, you know, like, and so that's kind of what made me kind of feel ick about it, but it's also Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks. And so you're just like, of course you guys are pals and chatting. I want you to be chatting.
Also, how many romantic comedies does the person, at least one of the love interests, already have already like engaged to somebody, but it's not working out? Like, that is like an incredibly common story device where like one of the person at least is like, you know, yeah, we're going to get married. Think about it. Like, first thing that went in my head is not a great example is Wedding Crashers, right? Rachel McAdams is going to marry Bradley Cooper, but like, we're not like, come on, Rachel McAdams, how dare you betray Bradley Cooper? You know, or like, that I feel like is in so many of these movies where like one of them, at least one of them is already in a relation and it's a serious relation, but they're obviously not happy in that. So yeah, we don't feel bad about them doing
something else. I think that's true. And I think in this one, we have much more nuanced initial love interests, because I don't think either one is an outright villain. No. Whereas like in Wedding Crashers, Bradley Cooper is like an outright villain, right? And I think in a lot of rom-coms that came after this, it has to, like, the current love interest has to be so bad that like you could never ever see wanting to be with that person. Whereas I feel like in this situation, like Parker Posey right on the line, but I think for the setting and for like what they're doing with that character, you don't look at her and think it's unrealistic that anyone would want to be with you, which I think is what other movies tend to do.
No, like, you're right. Like, Amy, I think that's such a great strength to this movie, that it's not the like, oh, he's such a, it's just like immediately though, it's like they're incompatible. They're happy, whatever kind of, but they are just completely incompatible. Both of them are so self-absorbed. I mean, I was expecting the two of them to end up together.
Yes. I thought that was too.
Like, oh, this is going to happen, because they were kind of flirting when they first met. Oh my God. I mean, like, oh man, Kinnear was just crushing it in this movie. He was so funny. His energy. And then, again, another place when they went to the 68th Street Lincoln Center movie theater with like the kind of designs outside of each theater, I was like, oh, hello, 68th Street. And then they're in the theater. The whole I forgive you part was a great little scene. That was such brilliant writing. Mm-hmm. You forgive me? Oh, that was great. Mm-hmm. But then their breakup was like so amicable. I loved that.
Yeah, I liked that too. And my husband was like, this is unrealistic. People that are that together don't break up that amicably. And I'm like, no, I think like if you're a grown ass adult and you just come to a realization that you're not compatible with someone, I could see it being like, we're going to part ways. Especially because they both had formed at that point some level of emotional attachment to someone else. And she was acting like she didn't. And that's fine, but like they both had
definitely. I think because it was mutual, they were both distancing, they were like, yep, yeah, I think so. Honestly, it reminds me of the scene from Annie Hall when they're on the plane and they break up with each other and he's like, be honest, this isn't working. He's like, yeah, I think you're right, you know, relationships are like a shark, they have to keep moving forward, and I think what we have here is a dead shark. and they kind of just break up. And I feel like it's reminiscent of that, but in a very different energy of like, yeah, we're breaking up. Okay, cool. Awesome. Good.
I love that by the end of it, they're jazzed for each other. They're like, yes, you're doing what? That's great for you. I thought that was cute. And she's getting back so much table space. Like, he has so many typewriters at her house. She has room for plates and vases and all sorts of things now.
Why did Hank have to move out of his Riverside Drive apartment, though? That's what I didn't understand. Greg Kinnear obviously moved out of that brownstone, that townhouse they lived in.
Didn't Parker Posey keep the apartment?
Yeah, but why? They weren't married. Who lived like I'm just kind of interested in like, I guess we're supposed to, this is again, another, like, look at how much of a good guy he is. He's magnanimous. He said, fine, I'll go live on the boat, Parker Posey.
Well, then she has space to do her incredibly complicated sleep routine.
I missed that joke. What's up with her sleep?
Hanks is stealing the caviar and Meg Ryan is like outraged. And she's like, how do you sleep at night? And Parker Posey whips around. And she's like, well, actually, I just take a half of this pill and another half of this pill.
That was great.
And then just put an eye mask on and pass out.
By the way, that cocktail party also made me miss my childhood. Because I remember my parents would have things similar to that. Not like literary cocktail parties, but like they would have people over for things like that. And like the dining room table.
Tell me about a cocktail party where there's a full turkey.
That was bizarre. That was wild. I know. I also love the framing of that shot was really fucking funny because they're like talking and they're like right in between them. She's like, I have a whole bird and I'm gonna set it down. And
go ahead, Amy.
Their fight over the caviar and like him saying, I have the spoon, I can take as much caviar as I want, and her being like, this caviar is for everyone, and she's like literally scooping it off his plate and like back onto the serving platter. And like that was them at like their peak chemistry with each other. Yes. And like peak charm. And you're just like that right there, like that energy they bring to that scene is why this movie will work forever.
If it wasn't Nora Ephron, who's like such a great writer of dialogue and stuff, I would have thought that scene, and who knows, it could be, was improvised. It had the feel of like, we're just kind of playing around right now with something. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to make a choice. Tom Hanks make a choice. And she's like, all right, I'm going to run with this. And like, they kind of like landed on that. But it could have been written down. I don't know. I'm curious to know if that scene was improvised or not.
Yeah.
I feel like it was written, but I agree with you that it does feel like riffing. Like it feels like they could be. Yeah.
Well, because, you know, the famous orgasm scene from Harry, when Harry Met Sally was riffed.
Mm-hmm. I buy that. Yeah. I didn't remember that, but that made, yeah.
What else do we want to say about this movie?
Was it paid for by AOL? Do we know? Was this product placement? I have to be on. Like, I was wondering that. I was like, this is really on the nose. Like, did AOL pay for some of this? And of course, like, there's the Evian bottle, which I feel like Evian's a very 90s water brand. I noticed some other, but like Starbucks, of course, is being referenced a million times. Like, Starbucks probably paid for that, right? And then I think the Evian, I laughed at that because I was like, Evian might still exist, but like, it used to be like at the front of like the zeitgeist, I feel like, in the late 90s, of like Evian was like very fancy water.
I don't know. It was criticized for its product placement, so I know they did receive money for it. But I feel like when you watch this today, compared to product placement and current films and like TV shows, it's like so toned down. Like, there's not like long shots of a car when then they're like, no. Hey, when did you get your Chrysler Pacifica?
I think too, it's not as obvious because the product no longer exists in that way. Like, I feel like if every time you opened your email right now, a little voice said, you've got mail. And then you watch this movie, you'd be like, oh, son of a bitch. But the fact that it's now nostalgic, that email used to tell you that, makes it endearing instead of grating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like, what's so fascinating is that like that, it's two things. It's like, you know, it's this brand thing of AOL, but like everyone was using it. I guess you had Hotmail or whatever, but like, come on, most people use AOL right at that time. So like that was this ubiquitous thing, but AOL is still a private company. So like, did AOL like, okay, like there had to have been some kind of agreement between America Online and this movie to be like, we're going to feature you prominently. And there's just the basic conceit of the movie and the title of the movie is this.
Yeah. Like, even if they didn't pay for it, they for sure had to like have signed contractual agreements that it was okay for them to use AOL's name like this. I for sure.
I wrote in all caps. Keep in mind, he put her out of business.
So that's my, like, my kind of two wrap-up questions. One is, like, I love that he turns the corner and she says, I hoped it would be you. But can they actually end up together?
That's an interesting, I was thinking that. I was like, it's interesting to have it. Now we're ending at the kiss because this could go in any direction, which I guess is like, that's okay. He doesn't need to, we don't need to solve that problem right now. But I can't see them getting married. Like, I can't.
Amy, go ahead.
So I have a pitch, which I now have. My new thing is to pitch endings to things. So if this was a romance novel, my pitch would be that when she finds out that it's him and that he is known for months, it perpetuates the third act breakup where she's like, is this all a joke to you? It's not a joke to me. I can't believe you messed with me this way. Get out of my face. And then they come back together and then it's like a true happily ever after. I feel like you can't have a happily ever after for sure if you haven't addressed that as an issue, because the whole time that he's trying to win her back, he even like vocalizes to her, can you be a person that forgives the guy that puts you out of business? Like, physically, can you do that? And like that, you know that that's his target, is getting her to forgive him for that specifically. And it's like, well, now that's not the only thing, right? And I feel like if this was a novel, like you would have that secondary conflict and then them staying together, like you would have that, okay, all the questions are answered. Yes, they can stay together. Which,
totally.
Like, a movie is a different thing. Pacing is different. The ending is perfect. Her saying, I hoped it would be you. I was like, obviously, yes, you hoped it would be him. Like,
yeah.
I'm all in. But if it was a book, I think that's how it would go.
Totally.
That makes sense.
I agree with you. Well, I feel like it could have been a different movie. Like I said earlier, it could have been the movie where she finds out that it's him, or they just, they both know each other, his other person, in the end of act two. And then they have that kind of rom-com, like, now we're mad and we're both sitting in our room upset and talking to our friends. And then, the kind of stereotypical running through the airport to stop you before you got on the plane moment or whatever. You could have, like, so it ended with the kind of now we're back together moment. And then it could have reckoned with that piece of dramatic. But at the same time, like, that would have taken that would have condensed everything else on the front end so much that you're not allowed to let this thing breathe. So I really like that it kind of just let their relationship breathe and develop. It isn't like some, I feel like rom-coms where it's like one scene, like the meet cute, and the next scene is when they fall in love. And then like three scenes later, it goes too fast. I like that it ended there just from a pacing perspective, that it allowed us to really kind of settle in to them feeling each other out and the kind of different nuances of their relationship developing. But I mean, you're right. Once the camera cuts away and once they find Brinkley, I guess he ended up running back up to him. Cause at first I was like, where is he? terrifying now. Like,
we've lost the dog.
He's going to run to the West Side Highway. Like right there. Like, guys, I'm really worried about this dog. I wonder when they talk about it, or if she, like, I hope one movie would have been, a worse movie would be like, that's okay. Or some kind of like, I really forgive you. But I feel like this movie wouldn't, these characters wouldn't do that. I think he would apologize at first, but then after that, I don't know what would happen to the two of them.
I like Amy's idea that they find it, that comes up, they fight about it, and then they work through it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think then the question becomes, can she be a part of Fox Books?
That's the great,
right?
That's
great question. Because she, like, then,
the children's book curator or whatever the hell,
Yeah. And then, like, can she reconcile with herself potentially doing to other people what was done to her? And I think that's a super interesting question.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't feel like she could. Like, yeah. I think she would really struggle with that. I think partially because her relationship with the bookstore was like with the customers that walked in, mm-hmm. and like being able to talk to them and be like, hey, you should read the Shoes series, which, great mm-hmm. series, by the way. Everyone should read the Ballet Shoes books. And not necessarily like the corporate side of it. Like, she hired someone to do the books. Like, she might have picked out the books that were in the store, but it was still like there was this relationship part of it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, which is part of the reason why she wouldn't go to Parker Posey's job, even though that makes so much sense in some ways, like why she would be great as the editor for that and the person who runs that agency or whatever.
I could see her being the day-to-day manager of the children's section in the actual Fox Books store that shut her down. Right. Cause then that's like, she's already,
that's like, you want to work at this one branch? Like,
but like, if he's stationed in New York, like they're still together, lives, I don't, you know, however people live in places. And then it puts them next to each other, or they could potentially cohabitate. And then she still gets her like day-to-day people contact. She gets to tell herself she's only working at this one bookstore. So she's not really a part of like the thing that's putting everyone else out of business. She's just working at the one, and she's already out of business.
Served, right. It's the same kids she knows and she watched grow up. It's the same community she's already serving. I can see that. I could buy that. Poor Chris Messina. I don't think he'd keep his job.
No. I don't think he has the inherent interest in children's books that she would require.
No, he wouldn't know what was up. Did Tom Hanks intentionally let Brinkley loose for the Brinkley? Like that was the cue. It wasn't like him walking up. It was, we all know that Brinkley's my dog. NY152's dog is named Brinkley. So like, I'm going to have that be my like reveal. I'm going to let Brinkley be the way that she reveals it. Not maybe like, hey, by the way, it's me.
So is there any chance that he was in a park where dogs are allowed off their leash?
No.
Okay. I was wondering
there are dog runs in these parks that are fenced off, like dog runs, but not in just like the regular part of the park.
Yeah.
So I feel like, yes, he was that thoughtful. Brinkley must be a very well-trained dog.
Yeah. I was wondering that. I was like, why'd you lose the leash? How's that? How, you know? So I was like, I wonder if he's like, this is what I'll do. I'll have Brinkley run. And then I'll call out to him and that'll be the signal. And then she'll go like, and that way I don't have to say, hey, or like peekaboo, it's me behind you. Like some way of like, by the way, better movie. But you know what I mean? Like I can let Brinkley do that ice breaking for me.
Without the Brinkley moment, she would have to wonder, did he only show up because I said I was going to be here meeting someone else? Because he knows in both contexts that she's going to be at this place. And the only connection that like he could call out that would indicate, yes, it's the same person is the dog's name. And yes. I will note, he was holding the leash when he walked up. So the dog didn't run away with the leash on. The dog was off the leash.
He unclipped him.
We solved a mystery right now.
There we go. We seriously did.
Which everything else had been so well planned, right? He would like have one half of a conversation, then go home and type the other half. I feel like this is this man. It's a good thing he was in love, because if he wasn't, he would have been an A+ serial killer.
Definitely. I love that really sweet moment. That was so sweet. The way he said it was so perfect. And I think it was the daisies part. And he went, "You told me." You know, and I love that. Like, it could be a creepy line. I could say it could be a creepy line, but it wasn't. The way he said it was so sweet. She was like, "How did you know Daisy's my favorite flower?" And he's like, "You told me." And like a little moment he let slip, he knew it wasn't going to get picked up. He knew she wasn't going to be like, "What do you mean I told you? Wait a second," you know? But it was just a little moment of him to go like, "I'm going to put this out here and be both people right now."
This could be a horror movie, you guys.
Oh,
like, this could really go that way.
It really could.
The soundtrack really is what tells you we're into this versus soundtrack. Like we're worried about this.
Oh, it's a great soundtrack. You got the Cranberries. You have it's such great music.
One of the things that Greg Kinnear says in the beginning is he references computers and says, like, in the internet, and says this will be the downfall of civilization.
Yeah, Western civilization. I love how he can't not be like, you know, a little bit of a Euro-centric, you know, Western civilization. Name me one thing that technology has made better. One, you can't name a single thing. I loved his character. Now I want to rewatch Little Miss Sunshine for him again. For some Pete Kinnear. I also want to know what movie the two of them were seeing. I desperately want to know what movie that they were going to see at the movie theater. I don't know why that didn't matter at all, but I wanted to know. Like,
so does anyone have a favorite quote that you maybe marked or just wanted to bring up?
I feel feel like there are so many. Like, this is an epically quotable movie.
Totally.
I'd be crazy not to turn myself upside down and marry her.
Yes, that's a great one, Jack.
Before they go to Cafe Lalo, which I loved. That's such a great line. And that, I feel like, such a great line, because that's before, like, that's just Cyber. Like, that just really talked about the depth of that relationship, in that already he's like, I am in love with this person. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, my favorite line is Birdie, when they're talking about cyber sex at the beginning of the movie, and she comes in and says, what are you guys talking about? She says cyber sex, and Birdie says, I tried that once, but I kept getting a busy signal.
Amazing.
I was like, it's amazing. I love that.
Great. Like, that's like, I feel like Nora Ephron, there's like a lot of like, it's like a Venn diagram between Nora Ephron's writing and like Amy Sherman Palladino's writing.
Oh, like, for sure.
It's not as pitter-pattery, Sorkonian, fast-paced, but there's that like bing, bang, boom, zingers.
Mm-hmm. I love the quote where he's like, if I had your address, I would send you a bouquet of newly sharpened pencils. Like, it's newly sharpened pencil season. Because he's talking about, don't you love New York supplies in the fall? It makes me want to buy school supplies.
So there's been a couple of films that have shot in Cincinnati. Like, we've gotten a couple, right? Like, certainly not as many as a place like New York. But it is one of my favorite games when a new movie from Cincinnati comes out to do like a drinking game of drink whenever you recognize where they are.
Ooh, I do that for Nashville stuff constantly. It makes me very excited. I'm like, where are you right now?
I don't know where you're going. You did not need to drive over the river.
Over and over and
yeah.
over.
Yeah. You did not need to do that to get where you are.
To go, the best one is they went from Clifton to Mount Auburn, which are two neighborhoods where like their boundary lines touch, and they crossed the river into Kentucky and back, like in the car ride to get there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was that one? It was like a roller skating movie that came out in the 90s.
Roll Bounce?
No, Brink. Like Brink.
Brink.
Where they go around Dead Man's Curve.
Yeah, so they do. Exciting. Yeah, they do.
Welcome back to Cincinnati podcast, everybody. This is gonna be awesome.
We'll start talking about Geta in a minute.
Yeah, hell yeah. We'll be fine.
Delicious. Yeah.
Love it. Yeah, so that was our movie pick for this week.
It was an incredibly fun movie. I gave it 4 out of 5 non-fat mochaccinos.
That's a good rating system.
It has zero bangs. Like, it's heatless.
That's the thing. That's what I was saying. It's wild how sexless it is. And yet it doesn't feel like sterile. Like, I was thinking about a great How It's Made movie. What was it? Something Nuts. This like insane old Barry Watson, almost Joan Hart movie where he's a nutcracker come to life.
Oh, yeah.
Zero sexual chemistry. There's no sex at all. And they're like, why isn't there any fucking in this movie? And this movie, I was like, only upon reflection today was I like, there was no sexuality. It was devoid. And I was like, yeah, didn't bother me at all. Normally, I feel like you should have that in a romantic relationship, things like that. Like, that has to be part of it. But it, and I wonder if it was just both because this is the movie, this isn't the kind of movie, but also with, if they're like, I wonder if there was a version of this movie that had that. And they were like, no, this is going to be like a 4-quadrant, you know, down the middle movie that you can bring your kids to. Mm-hmm. And it's lovely, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, speaking of kids, a kid I went to high school with is in that scene of all the kids reading books, David Steinhardt. I'm just going to use his real name because who gives a fuck? And his twin brother. Here is either him or his twin brother.
Whoa.
Shut up. Amazing.
And then here is him or his twin brother. Hello. Yes. What up, yo? I remembered that. Now I remembered in high school him saying, you know, I was in You've Got Mail. I was in the scene with the books. And I was like, all right, okay. And then I forgot about that because that was like 15 years ago. He told me that. And then watching it, I was like, I was like, oh my God.
That's crazy. Oh, I feel like, my gosh. Why were you not in this movie? Why did your parents not push for that?
And also, I laughed when that street fair is Columbia Grammar, which was like a lesser private school that was a few blocks from the private school that I went to, which was better. I was like, oh, Columbia Grammar. That's cool. All right, cool. Nice. Oh, and they're at that restaurant that they're at right by the Museum of Natural History. I had like a Spanish tutor down like around the corner from that. I went to shitty speech therapy right by where that Starbucks is. Again, I was like, oh, this is like, it really hit me in that level. This whole movie did.
Oh, gosh.
I'm just like, oh, yeah, yeah, great. Last thing I have to mention, and that scene when the dad, Joe's dad, is on the boat and he's not fucking spitting his gum out. The grossest moment. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
He's like, got kicked out of my house again, blah, blah, blah. And they're sitting in the yacht, his yacht, like, you know, Fox 3, Fox Jr., like they have their side by side yachts. Mm-hmm. And Tom Hanks is making a martini and he's like, he's just chomping on a piece of gum and doesn't spit it out or whatever before he takes his martini. It's like, ew. It was like
really
heavy chewing his gum the whole time.
Drinking this martini. So you're like, oh, cool. You're spearmint flavored gin now. All right. Maybe it was a vodka martini. I did not notice, but that part, but I was just like disgusted.
We do know that Tom Hanks drinks vodka because at the party he said Stoli on the rocks. Mm-hmm. And he said in a fresh glass, please, which was like, that's an interesting character moment that he's like, don't just refill my glass. I want you to give me a new glass for this cocktail.
That is interesting.
Of vodka, which is basically rubbing alcohol.
I think he put like an olive in it. So it's like a dry martini, basically, which is just pure vodka or pure gin.
Yeah.
Some people like vodka and that's fine.
Totally.
I mean, I'm laughing and making jokes, but that's how I drink my martini.
Good stuff.
That's everything. I highly recommend watching a movie to appreciate fall, even if it's not this one, because I feel like movies do a good job with how magical fall is.
Oh yeah, and winter and spring, like this is a seasonal movie, like it really touches on all the different scenes, but yeah, totally a fall. And then there's a whole Christmas element to it. I'm like, is this a Christmas movie? It's not, but
yeah, they speed past Christmas. There's like the one scene with the ornaments and that's it.
Yeah, if you're decorating the tree. Yeah,
I think that's all of my favorite parts of the movie.
Yeah
well, yeah,
fun pick.
Oh, so much. Well, it was thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyable. Just absolutely lovely.
I think it's better when we pick movies we like rather than ones we don't.
Yes.
Yep. Jack, is there anything you want to plug for yourself, your handle or anything?
No. I mean, if you're still into Hannibal, you can listen to The Ethical Butchers and watch all of Hannibal on Netflix. It remains a great show. it remains a great show. Ever season 4, we will get the tank gang back together, and I will definitely invite y'all on a crossover event.
Yes,
that'll be fun. But yeah, no, nothing to plug. Watch The Great Pottery Throwdown on HBO.
Do yourself a
favor.
So good. We've gone too long. We have to wait till we stop recording to talk about it. But like, let's talk about it.
But yeah, I got nothing to plug. I'm just a dad hanging out, not doing much of anything.
Next time we're talking about a book called Mating the Huntress by our dear Talia Hibbert. Mating the Huntress. And then we're going to kind of do, I think, another book or two, and then we're going to dive into holiday materials.
Yeah, we are.
Mm-hmm. We've got a fun holiday lineup coming up.
Love Actually, I'm assuming.
I think we are going to talk about the new rom-com on Netflix starring Brooke Shields.
We're definitely doing that.
Yeah. So very excited about that. And as always, if you've made it this far, you already know where we are on social media. So,
hey, we occasionally get new listeners.
If you've made it this far. I love that. I did that one time at a podcast I was on. I was like, if you're still listening, what are you even doing? But also, thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
So true.
Stay off. I did that a few
times on YouTube. Oh, if you look up Greg Piasso on YouTube, you'll find me eating things in my car while talking.
Oh my God. We have to link that. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll find me. Two of them are called Mukbang in the Movies, where I eat something while trying to remember a movie I loved as a kid. And it's pretty stupid. And then by the end of one, I was like, if you're still listening right now, what even are you doing in this world? Like, so I did Pluto Nash and I Spy, two great Eddie Murphy movies.
Watched both of them. You eating, not the actual movie. All right. Stay obstinate.
Stay headstrong.
Yeah. Stay a girl.